I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Chestertown will be holding their annual Legacy Day celebration this weekend, honoring the teachers and students who integrated Kent County schools in 1967, 13 years after the landmark Brown versus Board of Education Supreme Court decision declared separate but equal education to be unconstitutional. Today on Midday, one of the first African Americans to integrate Chestertown High School, Vanessa Isaacs Ringgold, joins me. Plus, Legacy Day Chair Erlie Ringgold Johnson and historian Bill Leary reflect on those early days of integration and how more than 50 years later, their community still grapples with the legacy of racial partition. And theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews a production of Aida by Art Center at the Motor House in Baltimore. First, the news.
And just like the river, I've been running ever since. He said it's been a long time coming, but I know my change is gonna come.
Change is gonna come. The Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin. She died this morning of pancreatic cancer at her home in Detroit. She was 76 years old. This programming note, Terry Gross will re-air her 1999 interview with Miss Franklin this afternoon on Fresh Air, and you can hear that at 3 o'clock today on 88.1. WIPR. Welcome to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Change is the topic that we are taking up this afternoon. A couple of weeks ago, we had the pleasure of traveling to Chestertown for a live broadcast of our show from historic Sumner Hall, a building that was for many generations central to the lives of African Americans on the Eastern Shore. It was built as a meeting house for the Charles Sumner Post No. 25, a Grand Army of the Republic post founded by African-American veterans of the Civil War. One of our guests that afternoon is a community activist and former member of the Kent County Historical Society, Erlie Ringgold Johnson. That afternoon, she told us a little bit about Legacy Day, an annual celebration of African-American history on the Eastern Shore that takes place in Chestertown this weekend. This is the fifth Legacy Day celebration in Chestertown. Every year, there's a different theme. This year, Legacy Day will examine the desegregation of Chestertown public schools. Joining us once again from a studio at Washington College in Chestertown, Erlie Ringgold Johnson. Ms. Johnson, it's good to talk to you again.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you so much for having us again.
And Bill Leary will join us as well. He's an historian who offered the first course in African-American history at the University of Virginia in the late 1960s. He also worked at the National Archives and on the staff of the National Security Council. He's also on the line from Washington College, I think. Mr. Leary, how are you doing?
I'm fine, Tom. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for being with us. And with me here in Studio A, Vanessa Isaacs Ringgold. She's a native of Chestertown. She currently lives in Owings Mills, and she was among a group of five students who integrated Chestertown High School in the 1960s. It's a delight to meet you, Ms. Ringgold. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom. Glad to be here.
And listeners, we'd love to hear from you. If you have a personal experience of integrating a school, or if you were a teacher or a white person at an all-white school that all of a sudden had some African-American students, we'd love to hear your experiences as well. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. So, Ms. Ringgold, let me start with you. What are your recollections of that first day of school? You went in the seventh grade?
Yes.
Because the high school at that time, I guess, went from seventh grade to 12th grade. What do you remember about that first day?
Well, first of all, no one knew what to expect on that day. My father, who had never taken me to school in life, I mean, from the first grade on, accompanied me to school that day as a safety measure. And there weren't any incidents. There were no, you know, people marching outside or anything of that nature. So there wasn't those type of tensions.
As a seventh grader, were you aware, for example, of the Little Rock Nine?
Yes.
Who had, you know, integrated a school many years before, I mean, 10 years prior to you.
Yes. And that was, you know, at the front of many of the minds in the community and not knowing what to expect. But, you know, that it was 10 years later, I think, when we were integrating the schools. So I think a lot of those tensions and anxiety had died down somewhat.
Yeah. And Early Ringgold Johnson, it is significant that Brown versus Board of Education was decided in 1954, but in Chestertown, the schools remained segregated until 13 years later.
That's exactly right, Tom. What happened is that their answer to integration was voluntary integration, which meant that some of the students had the right to choose a request to go to what were the white schools. Now, in 1962, we had the first student to go over. Her name was Patricia Bryant, and she actually graduated in that was her senior year. And then in 1966, we had Sandra Lindsay, who went over. Well, that was her senior year also, so she graduated in 1966. But in 1965, we had Vanessa Ringel and some of her, I think it was four other students, that actually went over to the white schools at that time. The other part was they had a few teachers as part of this voluntary integration policy. A few of the teachers that went from Garnett was the black school from grades 1 through 12, and they had a few of the teachers from the white schools come to Garnett. So that was their answer to integration until that time period of 67 when it was actually forced integration.
Totally. Yeah, yeah. And were you recruited? I mean, did your parents come to you and say, okay, you have the opportunity to do this, and did they prepare you, Ms. Ringgold, for what was to come?
Yes, and to most of that. We were recruited by the principal at Garnett High School, Garnett Elementary School.
And that's the all-black school, and yes, you were a student there.
Yes.
So the end of the sixth grade comes, and the principal says,
"So
we picked you, huh?"
Yes. So I was called to the principal's office, and that's not usually a good thing.
Never a good sign.
It usually means trouble, but in this case... And Mr. Hawkins was known to carry a big stick, literally. So,
yeah, nothing metaphorical about that stick.
It was a little scary, but he talked to me about volunteering to transfer to Chestertown High School, and the fact that they wanted this integration process to be successful, and therefore would like, you know, some of the top students to be part of that process. And so I agreed to do it. My mother was gung-ho. My mother was like 110% behind it. She worked at the local factory at Campbell Soup, mm-hmm, and was active in unionizing work there. So she's always been a upfront kind of, you know, civil rights type of person.
How about your dad?
Now, my dad, he was a carpenter, sort of a little laid back, you know. He hadn't completed high school. He served in World War II, but was very supportive. But my father actually gave me my out. He took me aside and said, if you don't want to go, you don't have to do this. And I think it was at that moment that I had that out, that I realized I did need to do this.
And Bill Leary, tell us a little bit about Garnett School, K through 12 school that the black kids all went to.
Well, Garnett was founded in 1923, first as an elementary school. And then they added high school grades in 1926. So wasn't until 1926 that African-American students in Kent County had a high school to go to. And 3 years after it opened as a high school in 1923, Elmer Hawkins, the man that Vanessa mentioned, who was clearly a force of nature, he dominated all aspects of life at Garnett School, both the elementary and high school. Elmer Hawkins was hired just after graduating from Morgan State in 1929, and for until it finally closed as an all-black school in 1966, he was the principal. So he was its principal for 41 of its 44 years of existence. And Garnett was an enormously important institution, a community institution to the black community of Kent County. Last year, for our exhibit associated with Legacy Day, we interviewed and wrote up the stories of African-American teachers who taught in the segregated schools of Kent County. And even though those teachers recognized that integration was the right thing, that it needed to happen, they were also all very proud of the work that they had done at Garnett, in particular, where most of them taught, and at other schools. And when integration finally came in 1967, while they knew it was the right thing to do, they also felt quite strongly, I think, that they were losing certain things.
Sure, and Early Ringel Johnson, Early Ringel Johnson, you attended Garnett, is that right?
That's right, I did.
And you graduated from Garnett, right?
In 1966, next to the last graduating class, when the schools were still segregated.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of education, as you look back on it now, having had a career and further education, what kind of education do you think you had as a high school kid?
As I look back on it, I'm convinced that we had an excellent education. We had a whole force of teachers and community members that stood behind us and pushed us forward. We had no choice but to excel. We didn't have a halfway measure. We had to go all the way. So I know it was an education, strong education, and once I got out into the working world, I was even more convinced that it was a great education.
And Vanessa Isaacs Ringgold, as you look back, do you think the fact that you, because you had virtually half of your childhood education experience at Garnett and the other half at the integrated mm-hmm. Chestertown High School, what do you think?
Well, first of all, Garnett, the black community probably wasn't pushing for integration because there was such a rich heritage at Garnett. In the sixth grade, we visited the World's Fair, the New York's World Fair. So I was coming off, you know, a visit to the World's Fair.
And for a little kid from Chestertown, Maryland, to go
being
to New York City,
to
that's fantastic.
They took a couple grades there. So at Garnett, you didn't just get a classroom education. You got a full exposure to cultural institutions and other things. So, you know, I was really looking forward to going to high school at Garnett and engaging more in the activities and things that were offered there. At Chestertown, and I think I had mentioned, I've always wanted to write a book called No I in Integration, because I think the individual kind of gets lost, but it's more for the larger group. And so at Chestertown, while I didn't encounter out-and-out racism, I mean, I heard the N-word directed at me for the first time, but I came from an era where sticks and stones break your bones, but words don't bother you. And I always felt it reflected more on the person using the word than on the person that it's being referred to. So I encountered, you know, things of that nature. But as far as classroom situations, I had lots of friends. It opened my eyes that to prejudices against others there was a Jewish girl in my class. I've heard the word Polak for the first time. I mean, all different ethnicities became, you know, I was exposed to.
Interesting. Vanessa Isaacs-Ringold, she's a native of Chestertown and one of the first students to integrate Chestertown High School in 1967. Airlie Ringold Johnson is the chairperson for Legacy Day in Chestertown, which takes place this weekend. And Bill Leary is the chair of the Legacy Day Research Committee. You can join our conversation when we come back from a quick break at 410-662-8780 or email midday at WIPR.org to drop us a tweet at midday WIPR to follow me on Twitter at Tom Hall, WIPR. More on Legacy Day and the history of school desegregation on the Easter Shore after a break. But before we take that break, a word about my conversation with Lieutenant Governor Boyd Rutherford on Tuesday. The Lieutenant Governor mentioned two public officials in the course of our conversation, Baltimore City Health Commissioner Dr. Lena Wen and Baltimore City Councilman Ryan Dorsey. Following that interview, both Dr. Wen and Mr. Dorsey contacted me to take issue with the Lieutenant Governor's assertion on two topics. The Lieutenant Governor and I talked about Dr. Wen's having to ration naloxone. That's the anti-overdose drug. Here's a part of that conversation.
Naloxone is widely available, and she has it. She has the money to utilize for naloxone.
Well, she has
told me
just within the last 2 weeks that they're still rationing naloxone in the city.
How do you ration naloxone?
Well, she's told me
that's a question.
How
do you ration naloxone?
You decide who doesn't get it.
So that means she's letting people die?
Dr. Wen has sat where you're sitting, sir, and told me that they are
Well, tell Dr. Wen to call me. Dr. Wen, call me. Okay.
We can tell her.
I mean, I've talked to Dr. Wen, but how do you ration? She has said that there's not enough.
I'm just repeating what I'm told.
That means somebody's dying. Is she letting people die? Is that what she told you?
She is saying that it's a very serious, there's a shortage of naloxone, not because the drug is not available, but because the funds to purchase it are not available. She's not necessarily blaming the state, but she says that the federal government could do more and that there's plenty of people.
And what about the city, too? You know, how much is she getting from the city on that as well?
Oh, I don't
know. We have provided additional money just in the last few months to Dr. Wen and the health department for naloxone or for anything else that she wants.
Dr. Lena Wen wrote the following in an email to me Tuesday afternoon. She says, given the limited funding available to the department to respond to the opioid epidemic, we have an algorithm to distribute naloxone to citizens, ensuring those at highest risk of overdose have the medication. Every day, we must decide which residents will be able to carry naloxone to save a life and which ones will not. This is the very definition of rationing. The health department does not have enough funding to provide naloxone to every resident in our city who can save a life, or even enough for each of the roughly 25,000 residents of Baltimore City with opioid addiction to carry naloxone. In 2017, a third of overdose deaths in Maryland occurred in Baltimore City. The city health department received 16.1% of the federal funding allocated by the state of Maryland for 2018. We have consistently requested that we receive a third of the funding, including most recently in a letter to Maryland Health Secretary Neal last week. These are federal funds given to the state, consistent with the core principle of public health that funding be distributed to areas of greatest need. One third of all of the funding from the federal government to the state of Maryland for this epidemic should be allocated to Baltimore City. Dr. Wen went on to say, Baltimore City contributes substantially to the overdose prevention efforts, including funding needle exchange and community outreach workers who actually distribute naloxone. Local jurisdictions alone cannot provide the funding that is needed in a state of emergency, which Governor Hogan and President Trump have both declared. That's part of a statement from Dr. Lena Wen, the health commissioner of Baltimore City, who tells me she has now spoken with Lieutenant Governor Rutherford. Baltimore City Councilman Ryan Dorsey responded to the Lieutenant Governor's assertion that Mr. Dorsey is satisfied with the Baltimore Link bus system. This is part of my exchange with Mr. Rutherford on Tuesday. But nobody disagrees with the need to get people from the west side to the east side.
And that's
how
why we
difficult
work.
It is to do now. And the bus system, this Baltimore Link system, which the governor has proposed and has, you know, put into effect now for a year or two, is not living up to expectations, at least according to the folks that I talk to who ride the bus every day.
There's some people, I mean, you talk to Councilman Dorsey, he thinks it's great. You look at the tweets that he sends out almost every day, he says it's good.
Ryan Dorsey contacted me immediately after Tuesday's show to repudiate Mr. Rutherford's characterization. These are a few of the comments that Mr. Dorsey tweeted on Tuesday afternoon. The lieutenant governor cited Twitter comments that I've made about riding the bus as evidence that Baltimore Link has been a successful alternative to the Red Line. Let me be clear, it is not. I have never said so. Baltimore Link and the Red Line are incomparable to one another. The Red Line was a needed plan for economic revitalization and job opportunity for those in the greatest need in Baltimore. Baltimore Link has, with little exception, made Baltimore's buses less usable and worse for people in Baltimore. In fact, the only lines I have used or commented on are ones that did not change under Baltimore Link. We still need the Red Line, and even if we had it, we would still need a bus system. Link actually reduced service and made the system less environmentally sustainable. Those are comments made on Twitter by City Councilman Ryan Dorsey in response to statements made by Lieutenant Governor Boyd Rutherford about Councilman Dorsey. They echo comments that he made to me when we spoke on the phone. Yesterday, Mr. Dorsey sent me a longer statement about this issue. We will post that statement as well as Dr. Wen's complete statement on our website. You can read them and hear my full interview with the Lieutenant Governor when you come to WIPR.org/midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. A little more music from the Queen of Soul at the Burt Bacharach tune. I Say a Little Prayer for You. Aretha Franklin, if you haven't heard the news, passed away this morning at her home in Detroit, surrounded by friends and family. She was 76 years old. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, it's the Midday News Wrap. Baltimore City Councilman and Chair of the Public Safety Committee, Brandon Scott, will join me with the latest on the Baltimore police officer who was recently indicted on charges of misconduct and assault after he was captured on video beating an African-American man. We'll also cover the latest news coming out of Washington, including the Manafort trial, the president's decision to rescind the security clearance of John Brennan, special counsel Mueller's possible next moves, and the continued fallout from the firing of Omarosa Manigault Newman. Plus, songwriter and ukulele player Victoria Vox performs live here in Studio A. That's all coming up tomorrow on Midday. If you're just joining us today, we're talking about an important piece of the history of African Americans on Maryland's Eastern Shore. On Saturday, Chestertown will celebrate the 5th annual Legacy Day around the theme of school desegregation in Chestertown. The landmark Supreme Court case, Brown versus Board of Education, was decided in 1954, but schools in Chestertown weren't desegregated until more than a decade later. Joining me here in Studio A is Vanessa Isaacs-Ringold. She's a native of Chestertown, one of the first African Americans to integrate Chestertown High School in the 1960s. And joining us from Chestertown, Bill Leary, the chair of the Legacy Day Research Committee, and Airely Ringold Johnson. She's a community organizer and the chairperson for Legacy Day, which, as I mentioned, kicks off tonight with a dinner, or tomorrow night with a dinner, and it's all day Saturday. You are welcome to join us as part of our conversation. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday at WIPR.org. Our Twitter handle, at midday WIPR. And Bill Leary, what were the other high school options in the 1960s for kids on the Eastern Shore? How many schools were there?
Well, there was the black school, Garnett, which we have talked about, which was until 1967, the primary outlet for black students. There were three white high schools at the same time: Chestertown High School, Rock Hall High School, and Galena High School. And then in 1971, the county built a consolidated high school, where all students thereafter attended for high school.
And how about the desegregation of the other three white schools, Galena, Rock Hall, and in addition to Chestertown? We talked about how Chestertown High School was desegregated, but what was the experience of the other two places?
Well, there were not nearly as many of these people like Vanessa, whom I called in our exhibit, pioneers. By 1967, when the schools were fully integrated, there had been over 100 black students who had volunteered to integrate white schools throughout the county, including Galena and Rock Hall. But most of them who did that were in Chestertown. The experience of integration after 1967 at Galena and Rock Hall, from the interviews we did, was probably more difficult than it was in Chestertown. To a student at Galena and at Rock Hall, both reported that the year that those schools were first integrated, several black students were held back the first year, not promoted for what they believed were discriminatory reasons. The students we talked to from those schools also talked about a lot of insults they had to deal with. Of course, that happened in Chestertown as well.
And Early Ringgold Johnson, it's interesting. We as we think back to this period more than 50 years ago, it's easy to understand how many of the white people, probably almost all of the white people in Chestertown, were against integration in the schools. But it was by no means completely embraced by the entire black community either, huh?
That's exactly correct. One of the principals, as we spoken of Elmer T. Hawkins, he always said that it would be very difficult and for the black students if the schools or when the schools did integrate. And as I reflect on those words, you know, he probably felt, and I'm putting words into his thought pattern, was that there were just so many things, so many advantages that we did have at Garnett. Yes, we may have had hand-me-down books. We may have had hand-me-down uniforms in terms of, like, some of the gym equipment and some of the gym uniforms. But on the other hand, we had top-notch teachers. And one of the things that we found out when we did last year's study, that most of the African-American teachers at Garnett were more qualified than the white students, the white teachers, and that was because it was required for all of the black teachers to have a bachelor's degree. With the white teachers, it was not required for them to have a bachelor's degree. And many of them actually had to go back to school to get their degrees, but then the white teachers still acted in a superior position to the black teachers, even though the black teachers were more qualified. Another thing with the white population, they formed a new school, which was called Kent School, which was pretty much a white flight school for the parents that didn't want their children to go to school with the black students. So that's one of the things. Every time I hear the school, the name, even today, I just kind of cringe because I know how the school started, the reason for the school started.
And that happened in Virginia. It happened in other places in Maryland. It happened all through certainly the South, where these private schools were established so that parents could send them to private schools and keep their kids in segregated situations. Vanessa Ringgold, tell us a little bit about your experience with the teachers. Were they supportive? There were even a few, as you mentioned, some black teachers at Chestertown High School. But when you went there, what were they like? Were they supportive?
When I went to Chestertown, I had all white teachers. It's interesting. My grandmother was a domestic and actually worked for one of the teachers at Chestertown. So I and and the librarian as well. So I knew they were very supportive of me. Personally, I think going in the classroom, I was less likely to volunteer answers. In Garnett, I would be the first one.
That hand was shooting
raised.
Up all the time.
I was volunteering for everything. But when I went in the classroom at the White School, I felt a little more isolated in the classroom. And I already drew attention just by the nature of being Black that I didn't want to be out there to draw more attention. And so personally, it kind of changed my interaction and my personalities. I didn't feel I was being taught like every other student in the class. I don't think I was given any special attention by some teachers, but I did have teachers at Chestertown that I knew.
And we should make clear, you were a good student.
Yes,
you,
I was.
You were one of those kids that the teacher said, oh, yeah, this girl knows what she's talking about. And that you were certainly an outstanding student at Garnett.
Yes.
When you went to Chestertown, did the principal understand that you were a very good student?
I didn't get the feeling that they knew who I was or any of that. The students, the other Black students that went with me that were in my class, were also top students, and so, I don't think that was anything special or that we got anything special out of that.
Vanessa Isaacs-Ringgold, she was among the first group of students to integrate Chestertown High School back in 1967. We're joined by Bill Leary and Airlie Ringgold Johnson, who are members of the committee putting on Legacy Day, which begins tomorrow night in Chestertown. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Our number here at midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @midday WYPR. Let's go to the phones. Elizabeth in Cockeysville, welcome to the show. Thanks for calling.
Thank you very much. I am so happy that this commemoration is taking place in Chestertown. And I worked in Prince George's County, Maryland, and was working in Glen Arden Elementary School. And the integration in Prince George's County did not take place until January 29, 1973. Wow. In the middle of the semester, the parents were upset and not prepared. The teachers had to be prepared. The kids had to change in the middle of the year. And it worked, but it was long delayed. And there was great fear from the white parents of what would happen in the Black schools and vice versa. And so I just thought I'd mention that didn't take place in Maryland until January 29, 1973.
Wow, that's late, awfully late. Well, thank you, Elizabeth, for that call. I appreciate it. Bill Leary, you spoke as part of your research for this weekend. You spoke with a woman named Sylvia Wilkerson Elliott. Tell us a little bit about her story.
Sylvia was one of the few students we were able to make contact with who attended Galena High School. She and her sister, the Reverend Sheila Lomax, both attended Galena High School when full integration came in 1967. Sylvia had some positive and negative experiences. I would say mainly negative. The one she told me about, the school bus ride to Galena High School, they lived in a town nearby, was particularly rough. They were subjected to lots of insults. But on one occasion, after she had complained to the principal at Galena about this, he brought all the students in the school together and talked to them about how that was wrong. People shouldn't be insulted or made fun of because of the color of their skin. But on another occasion, he intervened in a much less helpful way. On one occasion, Sylvia and her sister Sheila visited a white friend at this friend's house. And a cousin of this white friend thought that was wrong and complained to the principal about it. And the next day he called Sheila and Sylvia into his office and told them they should never do that again. And as Sylvia said, I couldn't believe that he would presume to tell us who we could be friends with outside of school.
Yeah, and Vanessa Isaacs-Ringgold, how about you? Did you have white friends by the time you finished?
Oh, yeah. I made many white friends at Chestertown. I found that we were friends mainly at school. We didn't really visit.
We weren't going over to each other's houses.
Each other's homes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We may walk home from school together at times, but you know, mainly we were friends at school. And the class that I was in, we had the doctor's son, you know, the doctors in town. We had the pharmacist's son, the business people's children. So I did find that after the 2 years of sort of the gradual integration, when the full integration came, all of those students that were in my class in seventh and eighth grade, all a good portion of them went to private schools,
yeah,
just to kind of back
they
up
left.
On, yeah, on the other.
Yeah. So how about you were one of five kids who started in the seventh
at least
grade,
five,
something like that.
Yeah.
Was there a bond between the other black kids and you at that time? Were you crusaders together?
Somewhat. We knew each other from first grade. One of my best friends, and she lived next door to my grandmother, was in that group that went. And she, I think, was a little more mature than the rest of us. I was always, you know, tomboy playing, you know, but she had a more maturity. She actually left. She went in the seventh grade, but she actually left and went back to Garnett in the eighth grade. So I, you know, while I had relationships with those students, my broader relationships with the my friends that were still at Garnett became a little distant. So again, that's why I think, you know, as an individual, you lose something in integration, because I kind of lost some of those bonds. My husband, Alvin Ringgold, actually also integrated. He's a year younger, but he was part of his seventh grade class or eighth grade class. They totally integrated that class. So he's shared some similar experiences as well.
Yeah. And Ellie Ringgold Johnson, it's interesting. We talked about this a little bit when we were down in Chestertown a couple of weeks ago. It's not been easy to find too many folks like Vanessa Ringgold, who are willing to talk about their experience. There are a lot of folks who are still in the area and a lot of folks, you know, who had this experience both as teachers and students. But as you've put this series of events together for the weekend, I guess you've encountered some reluctance on the part of some of the people directly involved to talk about it.
We have, Tom. The way that we work here for the Legacy Day is that because I'm closer to the community, I actually work with Bill, and I find persons for him to interview or for the committee to interview. And this time, it was very difficult. We found a few people, and we actually started relying on those few people like Vanessa and three or four other people to give us referrals of who else we could call during that time period. Some of the folks that we called, they just did not want to revisit that time period in their lives. And yes, it was difficult, but we are honoring 24 people, and some others are still coming forward now. Like, even though we couldn't find them during the time when we wanted to interview them, many of them are coming forward now to give us their stories, and we have a later time that we're planning to present their stories at Sumner Hall.
Ellie Ringgold Johnson is a community organizer and chairperson of Legacy Day. Begins tomorrow night in Chestertown. Vanessa Isaacs Ringgold was in the first group of students to integrate Chestertown High School back in 1967. And Bill Leary is the chair of the Legacy Day Research Committee. Thanks to all of you. It's a delight to talk to you, and I very much appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Tom.
Chestertown's Legacy Day celebrations begin tomorrow night with an honoree dinner at the historic Sumner Hall, and they continue through Saturday with workshops and a parade and a block party. We've got all the information on our website, wypr.org/midday. Quick break, and then Jaywin Russick joins us with her weekly theater review. We're going to talk about a new production of Aida by Artcentric at the Motor House here in Baltimore. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. We'll go out with a little more music from the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin.
Mm-hmm. I said, Mary, Mary, don't you weep and tell your sister not to.